Hi there. We'd like to welcome you to the virtual kitchen table. We are Erin from Everlearning, Haley from Taking a Kinder Path, and myself, Ashley, from Ashley as Mama and Storytime Shelves. We're gathering to have conversations about family life and home education, most specifically unschooling, which is sometimes known as self-directed education, or as I often refer to it, consent-based learning. We'll be sharing experiences and ideas, learning as we go. We hope you pull a chair up to the table and join us.
This is just a natural part of life, is that we stop, ponder, pick ourselves back up. We've learnt more. We set off again. And once we realize that we don't have to worry every time those doubts come, we just say, we'll work through them. We'll learn something else. We'll peel back the layer of unschooling a bit further. And we've got greater commitment, greater love. We've seen something we didn't see before. And it's not a problem. It's actually good. And that we're not going to jump off the unschooling ship and start all over again looking for something new. But then we just continue on. And yeah, that's a thought I had about that. That we, like being gentle, you were saying, Erin, about being gentle on ourselves, not beating ourselves over the head with, look, we've wasted all these years and we could have been doing something else and now it's too late and, well, I never get this right and I should be far ahead by now. But no, this is fine. We're learning still.
And I feel like that's also a de-schooling piece that we probably learn with our children too, is that I think initially a lot of people feel a sense of panic or concern if their kids are having, I guess I would describe it as like a plateau, or maybe they're cocooning for a while. So they're, I don't know, like reading the same book over and over, watching the same movie over and over, or sleeping more, or sitting out on the swings and just swinging. And so or maybe they're working on something, but it doesn't seem to be our idea of progressing, right? It's amazing when they kind of come up for air from those times. I often see this huge sort of renewal. Like it's a renewal, or sometimes it's a growth, but they're not starting where they were. They're in a different place. And it's this, I don't know, there's all this learning and development that's happening, but externally it looks very, it can look very quiet and just like a plateau for a period of time. I'd be curious if any of you have noticed that before with your kids, and just kind of as part of your de-schooling journey, is just kind of over time you see these patterns and it's a little less, I guess, concerning, right? Because I think at the beginning it's a bit concerning.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that recently, actually, because we do have this idea from school, I guess, that our children should always be progressing and being productive. And we think, like, parents get concerned or worried about their child not making progress. Like when you think of academic things, right, they're not progressing in their literacy skills. Oh, they haven't been working on their math. And we get concerned about that. And I was thinking about how what you were saying, Erin, how important rest is, that we're not actually supposed to be externally looking like we're progressing every single day. There's going to be many days or weeks or months or even years where certain things slow down and we're not focusing on a specific set of skills. But school's not designed that way. So if we're coming from a school mindset, that's where those fears can come up, I think. But I was thinking about it recently because my youngest, my six-year-old, has always been interested in sitting at the table and just coloring or drawing. And he's six now. And if I were to compare his drawings to some other six-year-olds, he doesn't draw. His drawings are very abstract and a lot of colors and scribbling and his own creations, rather than him trying to draw specific things like houses or cars or animals or people. And he's actually starting to talk to us about how he wants to be able to draw those things. But one thing I've noticed, and I'm using this example and why I've been thinking about it, is because I mean, like I'm going to classify or say that like art, I wouldn't necessarily lump in with like other academics. So it'd be something that I think most parents wouldn't be concerned about, right? Like maybe wouldn't even notice that. So my six-year-old will spend weeks, days or weeks where pretty much every day he'll spend some time at the table with his paper and crayons and pencil. And then he'll go a couple of weeks where he doesn't touch it. And I just think how that's an interesting example where I don't think many parents would be concerned about that. Like maybe if it were like if he stopped reading for weeks, you know, you saw him reading all the time for days. And, you know, that makes parents feel like, oh, spending so much time reading. Right. My other guy likes numbers. So and I feel it. I mean, I am not saying I don't feel those things. I do. If I see one of them looking at a book or someone doing math, I'm like, yeah. So I'm not saying I don't do that. But I did. I mean, and I wouldn't say, so I'm not concerned when they don't look through books for weeks or, and because I've been de-schooling, right? So I'm like, well, this is normal. This is how it works. It's good that they're taking breaks from these things. But I just have been thinking about, because that's something I've really noticed with his art and his time coloring and drawing, that he'll go through these phases where he's in the mood or he's inspired or he just wants to spend time doing that. And it's been years now where he's done that, where he spends, you know, a good number of weeks or a couple of months doing that pretty much every day, and then he'll stop. And some, there's been long stretches where he doesn't touch it, and it's not concerned me, but I have noticed it at times, and it's just kind of helped me, I guess, just know that that's normal. I guess it's kind of normalized it for me. I have other examples, but that's one that I've thought about specifically, and I like to think about it and kind of use that as an example, because I see it as like a, it's not really considered like an academic, right? Like not one that any parents would probably be too concerned with. There'd be a whole bunch of, it's like bike riding would be another one, right? I remember when they were, my oldest was learning to ride a bike and he would be on his bike every day. And then he stopped for a while. We weren't real concerned about it, right? Cause it's, you know, we just think, well, he'll pick it up again when he's interested in it again. So anyway, I've lost my train of thought now as to why I was bringing that up. But the point that I was wanting to make was just that it is very normal for them to dive into something, or for all of us, right, to dive into something and really focus their energy on it. But I don't know if there's anything where it would be natural to just, I mean, I guess, suppose there's something. There's probably, maybe everyone has one activity that they don't take long breaks from, but I think it would be normal for most things that you do take those breaks, and it's not that nothing's happening during that time, and that those breaks are actually really important, whether they go back to that activity or not. I think that's why I was mentioning that, Erin, because you were talking about those, what those breaks can look like to parents. And I think de-schooling can help parents feel less concerned about that once they understand more about the importance and value of them.
We got the other reverse of that too, don't we? That there's certain activities our kids seem to want to do all the time, and we get concerned that all they want to do is play video games, or all they want to do is, I don't know, but video games is a good one. And so we got the opposite, that they're really focused on only one thing for a while. And talking about things that you pick up during our lockdowns, I picked up crochet because I needed something to do, and I hadn't I used to do loads of handicrafts, and then writing and online stuff took over, and I found myself needing to do something physical with my hands rather than something virtual on a screen. That was all the contact I had, was virtual. And I needed something in the real world. So I picked up my crochet. But the other virtual thing I did do was play lots of computer games, not with people online, but just on my iPad. And I think sometimes it's a need within us that they have for a time, and recognizing that need. I had a need to not think about the world and all the problems, and to concentrate on a game that I was fully in control of, even though my life outside was out of my control. And so sometimes recognizing the needs of our children, where they are, Why are they overloaded? Are they, do they need a rest? Do they need a break from this, that, or the other? Are they finding, like, right, reading picture books? I'm sure we've all had this experience where our children bring the same picture book to us to be read every single day, multiple times for months, and we get fed up with it. But there's a need there. There's something in that book that that child is still processing. It's still interesting to them. Otherwise, they wouldn't keep on bringing it back and saying, "Mom, can you read this book to me?" And that saying, "Oh, look, I'm fed up of it," it's not really the right response because they still have that need. And so, yeah, I guess just looking at the needs, but why are they replateauing? Why are we all going all out on another, with a certain activity? But since I got my life back, I haven't pressed shades, so my blanket is partly finished. And so if I was a child, my mother might be saying, "Oh, but you started that blanket and you bought all that yarn, and wouldn't it look lovely if you finished it and put it on your bed? And really, you should persevere with it because it's good to persevere with things. You've got to learn how to get finished, start a project. You've got to finish it." So it's just amazing sometimes, isn't it, that you can see, we can see our children in ourselves or see situations that we worry about with our children, and we illustrate them perfectly ourselves, that we expect our kids to be, maybe not we, you know, the four of us here, but I'm saying we in the general, using we more broadly, expect kids to be productive all the time and to finish projects, and we don't actually stop and look at ourselves and the way we do things. Maybe if we look at them, we think, "Oh, look, we've got bad habits." I don't know if that's something, and we don't want that for our children. But just looking at those needs between what's happening in our children's lives and in their emotional, physical, mental capacities, what's going on that they're happy right there. Because I'm really convinced that no child or no person will persevere with an activity if it's not engaging them in some way. They won't turn up every single day and do something unless it has meaning for them. And the other thing is, if it has no meaning for them, they're going to drop it. It's got to be relevant at the time, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I see that's all such, yes, there's so much there. And when you're talking about the idea that for that period of time, that, you know, that video game allowed you to be in control, when obviously it was a period of time that there were a lot of things that felt out of control externally. And then actually, I'm not suggesting there are a lot of things that feel out of control to your 6-year-old, but it's just the idea again of having that agency. Like for him, this is something that he obviously is getting something out of, right? So when he spends those periods of time over a couple of weeks drawing, and even if, you know, it's seeming more abstract, there's so much purpose to it. We don't always understand what that purpose is in the moment. And I don't even think it's conscious for him, maybe, or even maybe for you, Sue, for a while with playing the game. We're not always aware of why we're doing things. And I think that that's been such a big part of deschooling. I know I've talked about this before, that it's not always my business what the kids are getting out of something, or to expand that to sort of life in general. It's not always my business what anybody is getting out of anything. And I think that moving away from that certainty and that control, it's uncomfortable. Like deeper deschooling is uncomfortable. I think at the beginning, deschooling sounds exciting. So when you think, oh, you know, when you think about it in that more, I'm just going to say like a shallower sense of, kids come out of school and, you know, we'll take a few months and just, you know, it'll be a whole bunch of summer holiday time kind of thing. I feel like that sounds fun and that sounds exciting, and we can relate to that. Like, I'm sure we have all had that feeling as a child of like holidays. And so when you describe it that way, it sounds so fun and so exciting. But I think getting into this more like dismantling, unraveling level of unschooling can actually be it's very hard work. It can be very uncomfortable. And that's what I think it can be so helpful to connect with other people or to read other people's work, because yeah, you're really sometimes coming up against things that, like I said, this idea that maybe we won't know what our child's learning and maybe it's not our business. That felt very revolutionary to me. Other people might have gotten there sooner, but for me, that was really a big piece for me to be able to let go of control. And I think the other piece, I think something that's really interesting about coming to that deschooling is, Sue, I can't remember how you worded it, but it's kind of like waiting. Like, we don't have to figure this out right away. We can wait and we can watch and we can observe. And over time, those moments that, you know, Ashley, you're describing around doing things a lot and then stopping for a long period of time, or Sue, you're mentioning doing, maybe beyond what a parent could be comfortable with. That's just not something that you can read. You can read it. Like, it's not that it's good to read it, but you have to see that pattern play out over time. So, yeah.
Maybe, Erin, at the base of it all is trust, that we have to build up that trust with our children, the connections, and that we have to trust them, trust their learning, trust they need that time, trust they're learning the right things for them. And the trust bit is so very difficult, isn't it? It's so easy to do things when we're not asked to trust. We can say, look, we really love unschooling when things are going as we envisage they're going. We just want to see our kids growing and learning and doing fantastic things that we can tell people about. You know, I've got amazing unschoolers. They've done this, this, and this. You know, we're making music videos. We wouldn't be doing that at school, all that sort of thing. And then when there's nothing much to report back to other people, when you've plateaued out, is it easy? Unschooling suddenly becomes very difficult because we're being asked to trust. And we can say we trust, but we only, there's a difference between trusting deeply and just saying, I trust when things are going our way. Real trust doesn't happen until we're being asked to trust, that we have those difficult situations where we maybe don't want to, but we do it anyway. And that's what I feel we need, is that those times we can look at them positively saying, I'm actively going to trust here. And that builds up our trust, because we're never going to trust if our kids always do exactly what we'd like them to do and do impressive things that we can tell people about. It's those, like our failures, it's those difficult times where we grow. And we grow closer to each other and we build up our connections and we trust regardless. Times when we say to ourselves, even if we don't say it out loud to our kids, I don't care what other people think. My child doesn't have to perform for anybody else. They're on their own timetable. I'm going to stand up for my child if someone criticizes them, and that I trust. And that is the really heart of unschooling. And I guess that's where we're heading when we're deschooling, isn't it? To get to a point where we can say that, when our trust is enough, that we allow our children to be who they are, doing what they feel is important for them at any particular moment, and supporting them and not worrying too much about what other people might say about that. And looking for all, I think in the midst of all those times, there's always positives. We just have to look for them. They're not positives that necessarily we're tuned into, because we're looking for certain things. But if we stop looking with a preconceived idea of what we're looking for, we'll see all kinds of wonderful things happening. It's just, yeah, letting go of our own ideas and be willing to look clearly at our kids and who they actually are. Yeah, because there's always something to be thankful for. There's always joys amidst the difficulties. There's always little things that will encourage us. Kids are always doing things that will encourage us. It's just amazing. And even if we can't find much, but we're able to say, hey, I love you and I trust, well, that's a big thing, isn't it?
So it was actually one of the things I jotted down on my list when I was going through your book, Sue, around trust. There's a lot of useful stuff in the book about trust, but there was one that really caught my eye. And I think it was titled something close to like speaking with trust or speak with trust. And what really stood out to me when I was reading that was I was reading and I was like, oh, I do that. And I find the trust piece very interesting when I'm thinking about deschooling. I mean, I think kind of what we're saying, like it all boils down to trust in the relationship. But I think why I bring it up is it provided something practical for me. So yes, I read all about the importance of trusting children. And, you know, in theory, I guess I get it. And there's many times where I think I do trust my children. But then like you're saying, Sue, like something does come up and then I respond in a way that I wouldn't respond in if I truly trusted them. And in your book, there was one example you gave about, the story you gave when one of your daughters were, you gave the reminder to practice piano, I think it was. And you were pointing out, I think your daughter kind of looked at you with a look, kind of like, well, of course we'll remember to practice. And I just thought that was such a helpful example for me to read, because I certainly still speak that way to my children. I can't think of an example that I have off the top of my head, but if I were to say to my youngest, oh, are you going to practice your drawing today? Or he's starting to learn how to play the guitar, actually. So if I were to say, oh, remember to practice, or something like that. Like, I really liked how in the book you gave that practical suggestion around just pay attention to the language that you use and the way you speak to your children. Because, I mean, you're not going to spend every day thinking about every little thing that you say, but to take time to think about that, I think is really important, because we'll say something and not even realize the message that it's giving our children. And I think that's important in general, but really important in particular when we're wanting to, I guess, I don't know how best to put it, but like when we want to really show our children that we trust them, or that we're working on trusting them, that we believe it's important to trust them. So I really thought that was a practical thing that you included in your book around trust.
It's really, I think, not trusting your children has become a virtue for parents, because if you have to keep them out of trouble, it's looked at as a way of, like, if you trust your child, you're going to expose them to danger. You're that type of lax mother or father. So having control of children and not trusting them is sometimes seen as a good way to parent, and there's a lot of people online who say that. So trusting can be looked at as, oh, that's ridiculous. But I was talking to my daughter Charlotte while we were on holiday at the beach last week about language, and we had some really interesting conversations. I mean, I recommend going on one-on-one holidays with your adult children, when you get adult children, Ashley, but the rest of us, yes, we have fantastic time. And she was telling me something she'd overheard. And the language was so totally different to what we would say in our own family. And I was thinking about how you build up a family language where you have to put the effort in to begin with, but then it becomes a habit about how you respond in certain situations, so that words flow off your tongue without you even thinking about them, because they reflect your core values. So for example, whenever my kids thank me for helping them, I will say, it was a pleasure, I love helping you, or you're welcome. You know, it just flows off. I don't even think about it, because what I say is true. I don't have to think about it. It's not words. It comes from my heart. It's foundational. So that when we have to think about our words and make sure, at the beginning, it might feel like a little bit automatic. Like when I learned how to show empathy during a counseling course, you know, we have to show empathy as our first state when we're counseling somebody, reflect back the feelings. And it just felt so artificial to begin with. I thought, they're going to know that I'm just trying to work up a good empathy statement here. Mm-hmm. But after a while, it came from my heart. I was interested in how they were feeling. And so it became natural. And so that our family language it should come from our hearts because it's foundational to us. But we do need, I think, to think about our words to start with. And so I was so terrible at the beginning. I'm not saying that I'm perfect now, but oh, I've improved a lot. I just think back to think about my neighbors when I had my eldest child, and I think all the things they heard over the fence, you know, with windows open. And we go back to our beginning of our conversation, Ashley. Well, I don't know if we were recording at the time or this was our pre-podcast chat about how sometimes we can talk to our kids. Well, we talk to our dogs like they're dogs, but do we talk to our kids like they're dogs? You know, come here, do that, you know, sit, do this, you know. And I think, yeah, that was me years ago trying to train my children and be a good parent that was in control of my child so that she would. Other people would think, well, you've got a well-disciplined child and she won't step out of line and she's a credit to you. And only now I think about it and think, those words were just so horrible. And what did my neighbors actually think? And I hope they were thinking I had a dog and I was yelling at the dog, a dog called Felicity, you know, come here and don't do that, don't touch. And I think the language is so terrible to use on a child, but it's what we fall into.
Yeah, I was listening to something a few days ago. I was listening to somebody speak about a book that a group of us, not the John Taylor Gatto, but another group. And for like 45 minutes, I was just like taking in this conversation, and it was so good. And it just resonated so much with me. And then there came a part about screens, like technology and cell phone use. So this is about trust, I guess, Sue. I'm kind of struggling back to trust, and then even just partly trust in our kids, but even trust in ourselves as we start to kind of de-school and unravel some of these pieces. And anyway, it was based on, you know, I guess there's just ever more research, right, on concerns about screens and technology. And so it was interesting for me, because I'd really been enjoying this conversation, and it got to that point, and it was very so like most people had like a 15-minute limit on, you know, maybe YouTube or Instagram or whatever. And I'm not, you know, first of all, it was interesting for me to move away from the right or wrong, because where my brain went was like trusting what I know works for my family, and going into the, cause there's like 20 people talking about different strategies and different programs to limit the phones and to limit the, you know, how to figure this out. And then I, you know, there was this moment where I was like, could I be wrong? Could I be wrong that this works for my family and this works for my kids? Like, they're talking about this solid research and there's all these different things. And just for me to move away from like a right or a wrong, like, I think that's been a big part of de-schooling. I mean, obviously, like morally, I have some rights and wrongs, but on many, many things, you can find research in 100 directions. And for me to move away and say, you know what, for this family, this works, or for these people, this works. And that's okay. Like, this is what they're choosing to do. But I guess to your point, Sue, about not feeling neglectful, I'm thinking, but it's okay that this works for us. Like, this doesn't, these sorts of limits and stuff in my family wouldn't work. They wouldn't work, right? Like, that just isn't kind of what the flow of our house is like. But it's funny how even after, I mean, I talked to lots of people about this. We've never had limits on technology. I mean, we've had some content conversations, and it's not to say that people shouldn't, but I had this moment where I was like, could I have been wrong all these years? And it was just based on people talking about like a new study. So it's amazing, just even like the trust in ourselves can be so fragile. And I think that's a big piece with de-schooling. And I think it can happen the other way. There can be some really strong voices saying, you know, if you are radically unschooling, you must not ever have a limit, or you must not. And so that can be really jarring for people too. So I think part of it is just coming to this place of getting to know our own families and our own connections. And it's about trusting our children, but I also find it's about trusting where we've come on the journey, and that for this particular point of time, this is what's working for us. So it was interesting how shaky I suddenly felt, because I didn't think, but it was because I had just been thinking about how much I respected the rest of this conversation. And so it's that black and white thinking, like, I like this person, I think they're smart, so if I'm not doing what they're doing, I must be, you know, something must be wrong. And so that's where I think dipping back into books and conversation, not as a how-to, but just different perspectives, helps us kind of think it through again and sort it through a little bit.
Can I just, something you said about connections there, because trust is never just about stepping back and trusting, is it? It's, you can't trust unless you know your kids and know yourself and you've got good connections. And I think that's the step that people miss out on sometimes, especially when we are accused of, say, being too lenient with our kids and not caring enough, is that what you were saying, Erin, about connecting with your family and knowing your family. We know our families and we know that we can trust them, but you have to build up those connections. You can't just say, I'm going to unschool this week, and unschoolers step back and they let their kids do whatever they like. And of course, my children are going to go and help with the chores and they're going to go off with their teenage friends and there's going to be no problems whatsoever. They're going to do everything properly because I trust. But without those connections, well, I'm not saying that if you suddenly unschool, there's no connections, but it's a deeper level of connection, I think, than is possible if our kids have been to school, especially. And that trust is something active, isn't it? That we have to put something in order to trust. And we have to know ourselves. Like you were saying, it's about ourselves as well. But we have to know ourselves as well to understand why we're suddenly having this panic attack because we've heard somebody, and have confidence in ourselves, not just the expert that you've just heard about, Erin. Because sometimes I think that if you, like, there's experts on the internet who are sort of like working in the field, and then there are the people out in the field who are actually experiencing it. And sometimes experience as a mother or a father is more valuable than a study, even though the study might be built upon questions that they've asked people. They haven't been there 24 hours a day with our kids. They haven't gone through the years of work with our kids, our change of our thoughts and our, just academic studies don't always tell the full story, I don't think. I think they're helpful, but I think that we have to trust ourselves and our own experiences more than the academic study. Because the people that it affects is our children, isn't it? Ourselves. We're not necessarily, if we write a blog post about it and tell everybody, no problems whatsoever, go off and have unlimited screen time, which I probably do. But have confidence.
Well, still out of context, right? I think those studies are out of context is part of the problem. I think whenever you have somebody telling somebody else what to do, you're missing some context. So whether it's, these kind of studies in the field saying this is the concern or this is the situation, they might be in certain circumstances. And it's the same thing, I think, when people maybe are really, really strong about, in order to unschool, you have to not have this. Again, it's out of context of that particular family. So I think it's really coming to that place where we're trusting our own connections. We're trusting what we need to do to support individual children it's been a good chat again. And I do have another thought that I think we had put down. So I'm just curious if anybody has anything to add to it. It's just this idea that within de-schooling, and I think Sue, I noticed it as I was reading through your book, often we're thinking about our children, but then thinking about our own child self as well. And I find sometimes, you know, for example, if I'm reading your section on certain like let's say math or reading or unconditional love, all these different pieces, sometimes they bring up interesting thoughts about our own experiences learning those things as well. So that's always kind of a neat thing too, and maybe a hard thing sometimes to kind of think, okay, well, how was this presented, you know, how was this subject presented to me or time, you know, did I have time to pursue this? And I wonder sometimes with de-schooling if, well, I don't really wonder, I think I know that there's some triggering that can happen at times that, you know, a lot of the effort and the time and the work that we do to kind of help our children have a certain life and see learning a certain way when we didn't have that ourselves can maybe be triggering at times as well. So I'm just curious if anybody, if that makes sense to anybody else, either one of kind of those ends of things.
Can we look at it positively that, yeah, that we learn, what I love to do is look back at our own experiences and learn from them and then say, I don't want that for my child because it didn't work. It made me feel this way. I didn't learn enough, that sort of thing, which I think a lot of people aren't willing to look back at their own childhood experiences and admit that their education or their the way they were parenting, there were problems there. Maybe it's too painful. But when we're brave enough to look back, we can learn a lot and we can move forward with what we've learned and make things better for our own families, but also recognize that it's not too late, that that we can keep, we can learn all the things that we wanted to learn about years ago. We still got the opportunity. We can still be the people that we were prevented from being those years ago. Yeah, we have to heal and it takes a lot of work. But if we look at it as something very, an opportunity we have that's exciting, that we have this opportunity because we're unschoolers to accept ourselves and to follow our dreams and to become the people that everybody told us that we couldn't be, that we're okay, because I was told I wasn't okay. There were so many things wrong with me. And I think by examining our unschooling in my childhood, and working through a lot of problems, which were painful, I can recognize that I was okay. It was other people in the system that told me I wasn't, but they're not there anymore. And I've learned from that. And maybe I wouldn't be where I am with my own children if I hadn't had those experiences, that I can take them forward positively and make sure my kids feel accepted and loved unconditionally and love myself and accept myself and to do all those things that people said I couldn't do. And yeah, look at it positively, but it does take a lot of healing, as you were saying, Aaron, and maybe being brave, having the courage to examine these situations and to move forward. I feel like I've dominated the conversation today, Aaron, and I'm so sorry. So keep jumping in, because you see the points you have put forward for discussion, my excuse is they're just so interesting and I can't help myself, but I really want to hear what you've all got to say about that too.
No, I think it's okay, Sue. I feel, no, I don't feel you've dominated the conversation, because I think, I mean, part of it was really to think about your book in connection with de-schooling as well. So I really appreciate kind of hearing, to me it's so linked to be able to kind of read these different sections, think it through at a deeper level for ourselves. And as I said, for me, it just kind of keeps circling around. And I do like the fact that you just put a positive spin on that, because that is how I feel. I think even just reading some of those sections is you, I think actually I've heard lots of home educating parents say this when they're learning alongside their children, things come to life again, or come to life maybe for the first time. So things that they thought, or maybe they were told they weren't very good at, suddenly they're like, actually, I really enjoy this and I'm strong at this. And this is interesting. And I'm finding that like as an adult, a lot of the things that I didn't necessarily, Well, geography is an example. I don't know why I didn't have a good year. I remember my grade 9 geography just feeling, I don't know. I just was at loose ends with it. I didn't understand a lot of the assignments. And so you get this idea in your head that geography is to be avoided. And for me, it's become one of my biggest interests, both culturally, like learning about different places, but even just maps. Like, I cannot get enough of maps and finding out where places are and then like measuring approximate distances and latitudes and like actual, probably a lot of the stuff we were actually doing in class. And so I think that it's both for me. It can be, I have moments, I think, with when I look at my kids' life where occasionally, let's say they grumble or they complain, I have to really watch that I don't jump in with, oh, you have no idea. I was on a bus for 45 minutes and I was at school for 6.5 hours. And then I have to be careful around those things. You know, if there's any sort of, I don't know, grumbling or whatever, I really have to remind myself that I didn't kind of go into this lifestyle to hold it over their heads. Like, that's not the purpose of this. And so then I know there's some resentment in there somewhere that's coming from. But when it comes to the actual, like, I guess what we would define as subjects or learning, it's just so amazing to see them for how interesting they actually are. And to realize, kind of like what you were saying, Sue, like there was nothing wrong with me. It just wasn't my time, or it wasn't presented in a way that made sense to me in that moment. Yeah. Does anybody else have anything, or are we good for today?
I think I'd just like to say thank you, Sue, for writing the book. I wish I'd written it. It's a great book.
Well, we're still waiting for yours, Hayley. Yeah. I'm big on encouragement. I will encourage you along the way, and I'm offering, I'll proofread. I will, you know, if you need any help that way, then I'm your girl.
Thank you. I'll bear that in mind.
So have your kids gotten good at proofreading too, or do you not do that? Do they read copies of things before they kind of pass the final line?
No. I had to step back from proofreading, Erin, for my kids, because when several of mine went to uni, and you know, they'd show me stuff and I'd think, oh, they've forgotten this word or that. And I thought, I can't deal with this. This is theirs. Their work. Not that I can't deal with it. I would be willing to put the work in, but I had to trust that they would work it out for themselves. And their work wasn't going to be mother proofed before they were allowed to send it off. They had to work it out for themselves. But I've got a funny story about proofreading. I don't think we're very good at it. There's all sorts of errors in things. And that has been another risk that I've had to take. When you find your first error in a book, and your whole world falls apart. There's a typo there that got past you. And then you think everybody's going to notice that. You know, it might be on page 2. They're not going to read the book. What they're going to do is head straight to Amazon and say, there's a lot of errors in this book and it shouldn't have been published. And that's what you think. And I've got two stories quickly. The first one was my very first children's novel. Someone did leave a comment on Amazon about how it was a great story. She would have given it 5 stars, except the grammar. There were so many grammar errors in it that she couldn't give me. So I actually had an editor go through this with me, the very first one. I paid for an editor. So I went back to the editor and I said, what does she mean? And she said, well, it looked all right to me. After a while, talking about it with Imogen, we realized that this woman who left the comment was American, and we have different grammar, different spelling, maths instead of math. We don't usually use the word gotten. We don't usually say we get off of the bus. We say we get off the bus. There's various different language differences. And this person probably didn't realize we weren't in America. and we're using the grammar and punctuation and spelling that's appropriate to our country. And so there wasn't any errors, not that I could see, but she frightened me. And then somebody else told me that they had done a proofreading course. This was a few months ago. And she said, well, if you or your daughters are writing any more books, she said, I was reading one of your books. One of, I don't know whose it was, she said, there was all these proofreading error, all these typos. She says, I could pick up on that. I could do better than whoever proofread your books. She said, who did you get to do it? And I didn't tell her that it was me. The errors were all due to me because, you know, I'd missed them. And that's a problem. And that's another aspect of taking a risk, that you do your best. And if we all hung back until we thought we were perfect, we'd never do anything. And that we should be a little bit more understanding of each other's, how much effort it takes to actually put ourselves out there and not to be too critical. Because someone, I read some advice that said, well, when someone criticizes, what you say is, well, have you written a book and did you do any better? And quite often, usually they haven't even written a book. And so you've got to put that into context and just do it anyway. But I can't remember why I was telling you that story. What did you ask, Kaylee? I haven't answered that question, but I told you two stories.
No, I think I was asking if your kids proofread your book, Sue. So I think with
hope. No. Imogen and I proofread each other's, but we obviously don't do a great job. So let me know when you find the first error in the Unschool Challenge. I'm sure there are errors. But you have to keep reading and reading and reading. And you read so much that your eyes get tired and you pass over stuff. And then you come back and you do it all over again. And then one day arrives when you say, I can't read it anymore. I've got to just press that button and say, hey, I got to just let it go out to the world. Let it go and receive what people say about it. And it might be good, might be bad, but that's all I can do. And that's all we have to do, isn't it? It's just do our best. None of us have to be perfect in anything we do. We just have to keep striving and learning. And one day I'll get a book without any typos if I keep going. But that's the other thing, isn't it? If we get despondent about things like that, we won't keep learning and we won't do anything else. And I was just thinking the other day, what am I going to do next? So I know what Haley's doing next. I know that Ashley's doing Clubhouse because I was asking her about that the other day. And Erin's been promoting, you're promoting, a homeschooling expert?
Right now the Honey, I'm Homeschooling the Kids, the How to Be an Awesome Homeschooler Summit. Although Ashley, I think, is very involved in that, or partly involved in that. Yeah,
but you've been doing a great job sharing it, Erin. I've been finding it hard to fit that in, but that's a good one. I'm glad that you're going to be involved. Yeah.
Yeah. Sue, sorry, it's getting dark here. I know how late we're getting, but I just wanted to say one thing about this, the spelling. It's funny in Canada because we have technically our spelling is British. But because we have so much American influence, it gets confusing. So just kind of like what you're saying, sometimes in my writing, I realize I'm using both. And we have a lot of French that comes in as well. So it's sometimes I'm thinking, like, I'll say things, but I'm using the French word and then I'm using like a British version. And then depending, you know, I've looked at my writing sometimes and I'm thinking, okay, well, that paragraph, this is British spelling, but then in that sentence, I'm using American spelling. So it's funny, but like we can really drive ourselves crazy. And so then I think, oh, I've got to choose a way. But you know, the other way to think about it is just that that's part of what Canada is, right? We just do have these different influences. And I don't know. I always kind of like it when, not that I like for other people to make mistakes, but there's something about seeing that there's a typo or that maybe somebody else doesn't have it completely figured out that makes you go, okay, we're all human.
That's what I was going to say.
A real person wrote this book.
Right? It's comforting. But because my eyes are sort of trained on grammar and punctuation, spelling and stuff, I've noticed that even the best-selling authors don't get away without typos, that you'll find typos in the best of books, the ones that supposedly have had the best editing, the best proofreading, and there'll still be typos. So
I point those ones out to, I point those mistakes out to my guys to show them as an example that even the professionals, so even the people who do this all the time, still make mistakes. So I get excited. I shouldn't, but I do. It's almost like a little game where I'm like, I found one. Look, there's a little mistake here, but as an example that's okay. If they can make the mistakes, so can we.
Exactly. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I know, it's funny, right? It's like you don't wish bad for other people, but there is that sense of like, okay, we're all human.
I think that we've had a theme today, Erin, about being gentle on ourselves, about accepting our failures and looking at the positives of failing and not being perfect and all growing together and realizing that we're continually learning, aren't we? And that's quite okay. And that we don't have to come over as experts and have everything worked out, but we have a lot to share with other people and we can listen and encourage and support each other. So it's been a really uplifting conversation, Erin. I've really, really enjoyed meeting up with you all. I always enjoy talking to you about anything because it's just so lovely to have you as my friends and to talk. But I've especially appreciated all the interest and the time you've allowed to discuss my book. That's, just so excited at the moment about it. You know, when you've just done something new and people want to talk about it or people invite you to talk about it. And of course, it's hard to hold back. You just want to share the excitement. And so you have been such gracious listeners today. And I just wanted to thank you for that. It's been a really wonderful conversation. It's one of the things I miss about close contact, say in the community, is getting together with people over Zoom on a regular basis to have proper conversations.
Yes. Well, you know, you're always welcome. If you ever have time and you want to, Sue, I'll always shoot you the link. you can pop on always. Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, thank you, Sue. And thank you, everybody. And I guess, have a good rest of your day, Sue, and evening for the rest of us and night for you, Haley.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
And this ends our conversation today. We hope you found it interesting and maybe helpful. If you'd like to connect further or see additional content, Haley can be found on the web and on Instagram at Taking a Kinder Path. Erin can be found at Everlearning. And I, Ashley, can be found on Instagram at AshleyAsMama and at Storytime Shelves. We'd be very grateful if you'd share this conversation with anyone you think might appreciate it. Thank you for your time today.